Welcome to A Quiet Life. I'm your host, Ruth Amos. 1 Thessalonians 4 says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. In this podcast, I chat to all sorts of normal Christians, asking them just how they live their quiet lives and how they integrate their faith into their daily lives. I hope that by listening, you will be encouraged to go out and live your own quiet life to the glory of God. You can find the episode show notes, the Quiet Life blog, and other resources at ruthamos.com.au. That's ruthamos.com.au. Now let's get on with the show. Hey, welcome. It's great to have you here. This is episode 26 of A Quiet Life, and as I record this, it is Wednesday the 17th of April 2019, and today's guest is John Zeckendorf. So John rose to fame in Tasmania by being the first Tasmanian to climb Mount Everest, and he's done all the seven peaks on the, so that's the highest peak in every continent. I think he'd done Australia's before he even started the process, but yes, he's a mountain climber. But he's more than a mountain climber, and he'd spent a lot of time talking about climbing mountains after he climbed the mountain, and so I wanted to talk to him about other things, and so that's what we do, lots of different things on today's show. It was really fascinating. I learned a lot about him, and it was a great interview, so I hope you really enjoy it, because I really enjoyed it. In my life this week, Moz went on camp last week, as I told you last week, and he came back completely exhausted. He'd done all sorts of amazing things like surfing and bushwalking, and he didn't get to go snorkeling, but you know, sleeping out in the tents and waking up really early and all those kind of exciting things that you do when you camp like that. And yeah, he was completely stuffed by the time he got home. So we've had a very restful weekend of just recovery. He's been recovering, and I think I caught a something flu-y or coldy, not flu-y. And so I've done a fair bit of sitting and recovering too, and it's been really, really lovely just to sit back and rest and say, no, this is what I'm doing right now. Nothing. Read books. I wrote some poetry on Saturday afternoon, so that was really great. That's my slow down and really restful thing to do, is to write poetry. I'm working my way through a book by Stephen Fry on poetry. I think it is called The Ode Less Travelled, and it just explains the different types of rhythms and rules for different types of poems, you know, sonnets, etc., and I'm enjoying it a lot. It's a bit of fun. It's a bit Stephen Fry-ish too, so if you can't cope with his sense of humour, I wouldn't buy it. I'd buy something completely different. Anyway, so that's been us, lots and lots of rest. We have Easter coming up this week, of course, and so we have the lovely contemplative Friday, Good Friday service, Friday morning, and we have the amazing uproarious celebration service of Sunday morning. So I'm really looking forward to those. I love this weekend. It's just such a great one to, you know, I love the different seasons of the church and the different holidays on the calendar, I guess, holy days, and just the chance to really concentrate on one aspect of our faith at a time. And so this weekend is just precious. And as well as that, this weekend we're having people over for dinner or going out to dinner a lot. So if you know me, that's not normal. That's very not normal. But I'm hoping, like, as my life comes together and is a bit less stressful, that I have more people over for dinner. That's one of my really big goals for this week. This year is to be more hospitable. And so, so that's happening this week. So it's probably a good thing I had a lot of rest last weekend, because now I'm going to do the hospitality thing. And the friends that are coming over are great people, and I'm really looking forward to spending time with all of them. Just this little introvert gets a bit scared about what that's going to involve in terms of draining my people battery. So maybe I just won't talk to anybody any of the other days. Okay. So that's what we're looking forward to this week. Easter and really concentrating on what Jesus has done for us and hospitality and lots of time with friends and family. And I hope that your Holy Week is holy, and that you are drawing close to God in this time of super celebration and remembrance of what Jesus has done for us. And I really hope that you enjoy this interview with John, and I'll catch you on the flip side. Today's guest is John. Hi, John.
Hello.
John became really famous here in Tasmania when he was the first Tasmanian to climb Mount Everest and all the seven peaks.
Indeed.
And yeah, so that's so that was all you could talk about for the next year or so.
It's all anybody wanted to hear.
I think there's more to you than that, so I'm hoping to hear. I'm excited to hear more about your life. And John and Joe have four children, one of whom recently got married.
Yes. Very exciting.
Amazing time. Cool. So, how did you become a Christian?
So, I grew up in a Jewish family. So, I was actually raised not a religious Jewish family, but more a cultural Jewish family. Mm. So, I did my bar mitzvah, went to Sunday school, and we heard all about God, but really in the sense of ritual and history. There was no relevance to your life today other than a whole pile of rules and traditions. But that was pretty empty for me, and I think for a lot of people. Mm. And so it didn't really mean anything to me. When I was 16, I met a wonderful girl who was a Christian. We started dating. I stalked her is probably a more appropriate description. For those of you who know her, this is about Jo. Some people often wonder. And we basically, we'd argue because I like to argue, and she thought she was witnessing to me. And that didn't quite work out the way she'd planned. And after a number of years, she decided, this isn't going to work out. I can't marry you if you're not a believer. And therefore, goodbye. And so that was kind of the slap across the face I needed. I went to work. I complained to all my colleagues about, this crazy Christian girl dumped me because I'm not a Christian. And most of them said words to the effect of, you know, that's okay, you'll find someone else. Mm. And one of the managers I had a lot of respect for said, she's absolutely right, shut the door and let me tell you why. Wow. And so basically he explained not so much the gospel to me, but he explained why it was important. And he said, look, Jesus makes some outrageous claims. If they're true, they're important. If they're not true, who cares? But if they're true, they're important. Mm. So I've kind of wrestled through that for a long time and then decided, okay, I better find out whether they're true. So I wrestled with mostly Old Testament prophecies. How do we know what the Messiah will look like? Because God started telling people about that hundreds and thousands of years before Jesus came. So what does that look like? What do we know about him? What's his job description? All of those sorts of things. And so about 6 months of wrestling through the Old Testament, and I became a believer in my head. I decided that, Jesus was who God said. He fitted the job description. And in a way that pretty much nobody else can. So that was where I first decided to become a believer. And then a few months later, I don't know how long we've got. If we've got hours, I'll tell you. So that's when I became a believer in my head.
Yeah.
Sometime after that, I became a believer in my heart when basically I was abseiling down a waterfall in the middle of winter with no wetsuit on a flooded river just outside Canberra. So what could possibly go wrong in that scenario? And as I was down at the bottom of the waterfall, I nearly drowned. And I thought to myself, oh, I'm going to drown. I'm under the water. I'm not going to get back up. I'm trapped here. And I thought, oh, well, there's that Jesus thing. Maybe he can help. And so it wasn't like a Jesus help. It was about as calm as that, actually. Mm-hmm. It was just like, oh, well, if you're around, then maybe now would be a good time for you to to intervene. It was very calm. And I got spat out of the waterfall that I was pinned under and managed to come back up to the surface, take a breath. And I realized that God isn't just true in history. It's not just something that happened and so what. Mm. I realized that he actually wants a real relationship with us at that moment and right here, right now in our lives. And that changed absolutely everything. And so I'd say that was the moment I got filled with the Holy Spirit, if you want to use Caro talk. That was when I really discovered not just about God, but who he is. We started building a relationship then.
So I have many questions. Going back to
I think it's interesting. I wanted to comment on there's so many girls, but also guys, I think, who go out with someone who's not a Christian and think that by going out with them, they can make them a Christian. What I find interesting is that your story is, hey, everybody, by dumping them, that may be the best thing that you need to do. When did you and Joe get back together in that process? Was it after you'd made the head decision, or was it? I really wonder what she was going through while you were doing your search.
She was pretty skeptical. I mean, she knew I was searching because she was attending a Messianic Jewish group, like a synagogue at the time. And so she knew I was searching because I was talking with the rabbi there and a few other people from there, plus a whole bunch of other people. And I think that was probably maybe a 6-month, 8-month period. She could see the nature of my questions was changing from just arguing for the point of arguing, which I still do, to actually he really wants to find out the answer here and he's wrestling. And so I think her prayers were changing from vague, you know, Lord, one day please get him saved type stuff, to Lord, now he needs to see you, and now he needs to find this, and he needs to understand this, and he needs to see your plan and how it unfolds over history. And so I think the nature of her prayer, so she was very much part of that journey.
No, that's nice.
We weren't dating again, but she was very much part of that journey. We probably had the same discussions we'd had 100 times earlier. It's just this time I was listening.
Cool. And how did your parents cope?
Oh, yeah. Look, I handled that really well. So I was, 18, 19 or something at the time.
I'm laughing because of the expression on John's face.
For the benefit of the camera. So I told them pretty much in the same sentence that I'd become a Christian and that Joe and I were engaged. So, you know, none of this easing in gently type stuff. It was literally both barrels straight away. They took it about as you can imagine. They thought, you know, when your little baby child suddenly says they're getting married, it's like that scene out of Father of the Bride where, you know, they view you and see you as a 5-year-old still. And,
yes.
And look, they had all sorts of reservations about it. They thought, you know, 2 young people, it's never going to work. And my sister was actually going through a divorce at the time. And if it didn't work for her, it's not going to work for you. Anyway. So Joe and I have now been married for 28 years. My sister's marriage was about 13 or so, so we're well past that. And even now my parents begrudgingly have to accept that Joe was actually a really good choice. Grandchildren help.
They always help.
So they didn't take it well.
They haven't come to the Lord?
No. So we better hurry. Dad's 96 now and Mum's 80, nearly 86. We're still praying. It's only been 30 years for them, so... Yeah, that's still early days in...
Well, considering the amount of time before that.
Sadly, there's a bit of history there too. I think, you know, God says to Isaiah in Isaiah 6, go and tell the people, but guess what? They're not going to listen. And it'll be right in front of them and they won't see it. And they'll hear it, but they won't understand. And sadly, that veil that he talks about is still around. So if anyone listening to this is witnessing to Jewish people... It takes a lot longer than it does for most other people groups. And it is really hard work, and it does require, I think, God to lift that veil. And suddenly, you know, I've heard rabbis talk about the Messiah, and they're talking about what he'll look like, and you're just like, how are you missing this? Like, you're describing stuff. You're literally describing Jesus and nobody else. And how could you possibly miss that, you know, it's like the pantomimes. It's behind you.
Absolutely.
So,
Cool. What do you do for a job?
So I overheard Nathaniel, our son, talking to his friends when he was about 16, and the usual question of like, oh, so what does your dad do? And Nathaniel said, I'm not sure, but he seems to swan around the world having cups of coffee with people in hotel lobbies, which upon reflection was remarkably accurate. I think a few years later, I took him on a road trip with me, and he actually came around and saw what I did. And I asked him afterwards, so, you know, was that good? And he said, oh, it's awesome. It's awesome. I got so much better idea of what do you do. I said, oh, so what is it you think I do? I still have no idea. So my daughters are convinced I'm a spy because I travel a lot at short notice. What I actually do is we run a bunch of different businesses. So some of those businesses, we own and operate regional hotels. So that's what's currently getting me travelling around. Mm. We used to do real estate development in India. We've got an IT company and we do a whole bunch of other weird stuff. So yeah. Just international man of mystery, I think, is the...
I remember when I was a kid, I just had this real desire to know what happened in an office, and I'd ask people, like, so, you know, in your kind of job, that's the response I'd get. Don't worry about it. I'd just be like, this mystery thing that my dad goes and does. Robin League was his secretary, and I'm just like, tell me what happened. Yeah, so I'm getting the idea now.
It must be good because you spend so much time doing
it. Yeah.
Well, I can't actually stand in office, and I'm not very good at paperwork, so despite being an accountant. So I'm an accountant by training, right. But I've never actually worked as
so
an accountant.
More people management.
Situation management. So all my early days, I was actually doing insolvency in the late 80s, early 90s. Wow. So that was a fun time to do insolvency. So a lot of the corporate work we do at the moment is crisis management, but not, you know, oh, my IT system burnt down. It's more, oh dear, my banking system burnt down.
Yeah.
Yes. So a lot of our specialisms in finance and things that we haven't really needed in Australia for some time, but we may do one day.
Yeah. Yeah. So how does your faith show in that kind of work?
I think a lot of people tend to split faith from... I have my secular life and I have my sacred life. And they've taken the instruction that, well, it wasn't really an instruction. I think they've misunderstood the separation of church and state. The idea of that wasn't to stop the church polluting the state. It was to stop the state polluting the church.
Yeah.
And I think these days we understand it the other way around, and we try and interpret it in that way, and it just doesn't work. So Jesus doesn't say, give me your Sundays and maybe Wednesday nights or maybe Friday nights. What he says is, I want everything. And so everything we are belongs to him, and he's paid the price for that, and he's entitled to it, and it's a gift we give. It's the only thing we can give willingly back to him. And so I think a lot of people try and split those things, and for me there's no separation in that. Being in the secular world allows me to access people that professional ministers could never go near, because they have to deal with me. That's part of the business. They either work for me, in which case they really have to deal with me or put up with me, or they're our suppliers or people we have relationships with. And so that gives me an ability to access those people in a very natural way and be able to bring Jesus to them, because they're probably never going to walk into a church of their own free will. And so, you know, I think that's most of Australia these days. An incredible number of people just don't know anyone that knows Jesus anymore. It used to be true, but I don't think it's true.
Yeah.
You know, you've got on the census more than half of Australians tick the box saying, yes, I'm a Christian. But what they mean by that is radically different to what I mean when I say I'm a follower of Jesus. And so I think it's really important to be in the secular world. I don't think, you know, when we think our ministers are called to full-time ministry, the answer is no, we're all called to full-time ministry. Yeah. They just serve in a different way. And so I think that's true for all of us. That's our job.
Yeah. So do you find that you have deeper conversations with people? Or?
So sometimes. Sometimes. So I think it's like anyone, you end up with this spectrum of responses, and that changes over time depending on what they're going through in their life. So one of the things, I love climbing mountains, and one of the things I've discovered, the best time to talk to people about Jesus is on the way back down. Because they're a lot more relaxed. They've finished with it. If you try and get them on the way up. And I think that's true in every part of life. You've got to find the right moments where the Spirit has opened a softening in their hearts and they're ready to hear. I think if you get that wrong, it's pearl before swine. And you can give the best gospel presentation you've ever given and it just goes absolutely nowhere because the timing's not right. And that's why you can't set up a cup of coffee and say, let me tell you about Jesus. It takes quite some time to get to the point where you might be able to do that.
There's a building of relationship. There's a showing your integrity in your work practices and there's all that.
All that. If we're doing it right, and I frequently don't, but if we're doing it right, then we should be shining Jesus's light. And a lot like the manager that was in the right place at the right time to have the right word to me when I was ready to hear it.
Yeah.
He'd probably said 50 other things that I'd completely missed before that. It was when he was in the right place at the right time for that. And one great story on that, we had a friend and I were both fairly full-on Christians. We were working in a big accounting firm, and our department had 34 people on the internal telephone list. And we were just a small department in a much bigger company.
Mm.
And so every once a week we would sit down and pray for everybody on that list for opportunities. And within 3 years, by the time my friend went off to Bible college, three had become Christians. We'd had meaningful conversations with all of them except the head honcho. And he was really hard work. And we both tried, and he was hard to access. And, you know, we were too far down the food chain for him to pay any attention. And then I think it was his wife had just died. My friend had gone to Bible college. And I was sitting on an aeroplane coming back from a meeting with him. And he said to me, "Oh, you knew Craig pretty well, the other guy." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I just don't get why he left, you know, a promising career to go and work for, to go and, you know, join the church and to become a minister." So we got our opportunity. And about 6 months later, I called up Craig and said, "We got him." Yeah. Last one on the list.
Awesome.
So, you know, he didn't become a believer, but he was ready to hear the word at that time.
And I think what's so cool about that story is the prayer that went into it beforehand, because I just see that all the time. Like, if you don't, if you're not praying, it can't happen. You've got to you got to pray in first, and then listening to
There's stuff we can do and we're told to do, and there's stuff we can't do and we're told we can't do. And understanding the difference will save you a lot of frustration. So if you if you're trying to force it in your own timing, or when the person's not open to it, it is literally going to be, at best, the seed will be scattered, but it's most likely going to be just pearl before swine. But when they're ready to hear it, it's totally different. So what changes that? Well, the Lord does. That's really the Holy Spirit. And if you can pray that into people, say, "Lord, I want those opportunities. I don't have to give them, you know, 10 points of the gospel all at once. I can just have to get one thing across to them." And quite often, I think we go for the slam dunk. And we're looking for the close, but our focus then becomes on trying to convert people rather than disciple them. And what we're really trying to do is disciple people. And that's, I think, maybe a distinction that we forget sometimes.
Nice. So you mentioned mountains.
It's a few of those.
What do you enjoy about climbing mountains?
Mountains are awesome. I mean, first of all, up until recently, no mobile phones or internet connection on them. So it was actually a really great way of getting away and actually getting some really good quality thinking time. When I was climbing in Alaska, we were there for about 4 weeks. I read through about 2/3 of the Bible. I didn't have time to finish it off. And I was praying for about 6 to 8 hours a day. I just don't get that at home, and I don't get that in my normal life, and I don't think most of us do. So I love that bit about it. I love the physical challenge of it. I love being out in God's amazing creation. And that can be the back garden. But in the back garden, we don't get, you know, the ice crystals that you can see up on a mountain. You don't get the, you know, the staggering beauty that comes in the mountains. And I can get that in mountains. I can get it in rivers. It doesn't matter where, but yeah, I do like the high places.
You like the challenge as well.
I love the physical challenge of it. A lot of people think I couldn't possibly do that. And the answer is you probably could. It's just, it's a lot of hard work. So a lot of that comes down to, are you prepared to put in the work? How well do you plan? I like that, you know, I've got a 7-year goal rather than I'm trying to work out what I'm doing tomorrow. So it's nice to actually work towards a bigger goal and then think, gee, I don't know if I can actually do that, but let me find out. Most people already assume they can't do it, so they stay on the couch and they never actually give it a go. Despite all the pain I've put my body through, I've never actually had my body fail yet. So I'm still well back from the edge of what I can physically do. Actually, that's not quite true. I got sick on my last climb and had to stay in bed. But apart from that...
Yeah, that was a shame.
So, well, it was, but that's okay. It was still pretty beautiful up there, and still great experience.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I always tell people that you know, Moses went up the mountain to talk to God, and Jesus went up the mountain to you know, be alone with God, and you know, therefore I'm going up the mountain to be with God. To some extent, that's true. You discover things about yourself and about depending on the Lord in a high stress situation that you probably won't in regular life. But for some people, their high-stress situation is their regular life. And there are plenty of people who climb, you know, much bigger mountains than I do, just not physical ones.
That's true. When did you start climbing?
So actually climbing in about 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
Oh, okay. So it's not a from childhood thing.
No, well, I've done outdoor stuff all my life. So yeah. I've been sort of grew up in scouts and learnt all the ropes, so I learnt about climbing and did, you know, a lot of abseiling, a lot of canyoning, a lot of, you know, quite technical abseiling.
Mm.
My son and I were invited on a medical clinic in India. And there were actually we went 3 years in a row to help out some doctors with just crowd management and entertaining the children in Nathaniel's mm-hmm. case. And so we went up into the Himalayas and did a series of medical clinics in remote villages as part of a trek into the base camp of Kanchenjunga, which is the third highest mountain. And I'd heard about climbers, I'd seen the photos, I never really got it. And we got to base camp of Kanchenjunga at the end of this valley that we'd been sort of helping people up, and just stared up at the mountains and just like, wow, that's big.
Yeah.
That's where we thought, oh, maybe we should give this a go. So Kilimanjaro seemed like a good idea. Mm. So we started with that, and then realized we'd now done two of the seven summits. So we thought maybe we should have a hack at some others.
Cool.
So, basically one big climb a year and occasionally one and a half.
Cool. Nice. So I think you've probably mentioned some already, but I had my question written down.
Oh,
so
okay.
Lessons about climbing, or lessons that you've learned from climbing that we can apply to our lives if we're not climbing.
I think, well, everybody climbs. One of the questions I love interviewing people with when we're looking for senior staff, doesn't work so well with junior staff, but with senior staff, you say, when did you do something you thought you couldn't do? Mm. And what happened when you got to the other side of what you thought you couldn't do? And that's a very true analogy for climbing.
Mm.
You think you can't climb it, and then you realize it's about just taking the next step.
Mm.
And never mind the big picture, never mind the huge mountain in front of you, just keep taking the next step until there's no more next steps to take and you're on top. Sounds easy, but that's an awesome metaphor for life.
Mm.
Now, some of those steps, as you step up, you slide back down. And that's very true on mountains. They're often slippery. They're often covered in soft snow or scree or things like that. So you step up, slide back down. And sometimes you slide back down more than the step you just took.
Yeah.
And so I think that's an awesome metaphor for life as well. That a lot of people really, you know, and we struggle in our faith. And some days we go, wow, it's awesome. I'm on cloud nine. I've just had 20 minutes of awesome quiet time. And I've read the Bible and all that sort of stuff, and that's great, but not all days are like that. And I think some days we do, you know, some days we disappoint ourselves.
Mm.
As Paul says, we do what we know we ought not to do, and we don't do what we know we should. And that's like the sliding back down.
Mm.
So I think there's all these metaphors in climbing that are actually really good and help you maybe understand a bit more about life, but also about your faith and where that's coming from.
There's a teamwork thing too, I'm guessing.
There is. Who you go with is a massive, like a big rule for life and a big rule for... So if I hang around with the wrong people all the time, the odds are on I'm not going to change them, they're going to change me.
Yeah.
And so getting... And particularly, you know, we look at our kids and we say, you've got to watch who you're hanging with because you think you're having a positive influence on them, but more likely they're just going to change your view and drag you away from the Lord.
Mm.
And so there is a danger in that. I have climbed with the wrong teams, and I strongly suggest you don't do that. we were both unsuccessful and it wasn't a fun trip.
Mm.
We've had other trips where it was unsuccessful, but it was still good.
Mm.
We've had other trips where it would have only been possible because we had a great team. One of my climbing friends said, some days you put into the group and some days you need to take out from it.
Mm.
And it's true.
Mm.
You're having a bad day, then somebody else carries a bit of your luggage. That makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Other days you're feeling strong, they're not, so you carry a bit of theirs.
Yeah.
And that teamwork can make a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
So you've talked about praying for 6 hours on a mountain climb or whatever. Are there other times apart from on the mountains when you feel close to God?
I'm too busy to most of the time. I think we often get overruled by our feelings, and I think that can be quite dangerous. I think the love we're called to have for Jesus, and it's the same love that I think we're called to have in our marriages. And I think a lot of people have this idea of, I have to feel in love. The command is to love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and so on. And that's actually an instruction, not a feeling. And so the Bible talks about different types of love, and there's three different Greek words for it. And one of the Greek words is agape, which is a committed love. It's a love that is an act of will, not just a feeling. It's not an emotion. It's not a, you know, it's an act of will. And I think we often expect to feel on cloud nine all the time. And as somebody pointed out, there'd be no mountains without valleys. And so you really need to put those two things together and say, I may feel like I'm close to God, but that's a feeling. I need to push into God regardless of whether I feel like I'm close to him or not. And I need to make a conscious decision to do that. And sometimes that means overruling what the world says and not being like the rest of them. And sometimes that overrules how you're feeling. You know, oh, I don't feel like it, I'm so tired. Yeah, that's probably when you need God more.
That's right. Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, you come under spiritual attack as well. And so I think all these things are screaming at you, go a different way. And that's the time when you most need to press into God. Doesn't matter whether you feel like it. I think the feeling comes sometimes afterwards.
Yeah, nice. So what's one thing about God and Christianity that you wish everyone knew?
Jesus. It's the only thing.
Yeah.
Sorry, I think that's one of the Sunday school questions.
Yeah,
every
yeah.
answer has to be Jesus.
Jesus.
Yeah, look, Christianity isn't about what you do. It's about what God has done. And you're not reaching out to him. He's reached out to you. And he's made that possible through Jesus. You know, great analogy of, I go to a restaurant, I eat a fantastic meal, but I've got no money. And Jesus comes along and picks up the tab. And that's kind of what we do with our lives. We don't follow God's way. If God is completely holy and he's like the white sheet, and we come along as a black speck, we can't be close to him because our black speck will make the white sheet not white anymore. And so the only way we can come close to him is if we're basically bleached white. And that's pretty much what Jesus does. And so we think we've got to earn it. We can't. The Bible makes that really clear. We think we've got, you know, we think we're entitled to it. We're not. What we're entitled to is to be a black speck and to continue that. And I think, so yeah, Jesus is absolutely the thing that changes it. What we do with it after that gets really tricky, because I think we often aren't very good at following Jesus and we forget the basics and we don't continue to grow and learn. And we just stagnate. So seek Jesus always. If you don't know him, definitely seek Jesus. If you do know him, keep growing that relationship. It's like any relationship. You don't talk to your wife for 6 months, it's probably not going to be a good relationship. You don't talk to, so why do we expect any different in prayer? Do we pray to God? Do we do that regularly? We're told to do it without ceasing. That's an awful lot, but do we do it really regularly? I caught myself the other day and thought, I need to pray before every meeting I go into. And I've just been doing that in the last week or so. It's amazing what difference it makes. Who'd have thought? And so it's really basic stuff that we just forget to do. We think, oh yeah, I'll deal with that on Sunday, or I'll pray on Sunday, or I'll go to you know, Wednesday night prayer meeting or whatever. But no, it's an all-the-time relationship. And if you don't invest in that relationship, it's probably not going to mean much to you.
Yeah.
That was a very long answer, sorry.
No, it's great. It's fantastic. Well, that's the end of my questions.
Woo-hoo.
Thank you very much for sharing this, John. That was great.
Pleasure.
Well, I hope you're encouraged by that chat with John as you face mountains in your life. I hope that you're encouraged to just keep taking the next step. Next week, we'll be talking to Romola. Romola is a midwife, and I thought after conversations with people in palliative care that it would be good to go to the other extreme and have a chat to somebody who works at the beginning of life as a midwife. I want to thank Catherine Joy, especially for the music for this podcast, and to remind you that if you want to chat with me, you can do that by email at ruth@ruthamos.com.au, by Facebook, Ruth Amos Author, Twitter, @aquietlife, and if you want to support me, you can do that on Patreon/quietlife. Don't forget to share this with people if you think it'll be helpful, or go on iTunes and give me a rating. That would be really helpful. See you next week.